All right, coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, our guest is David Aldridge of Turner Sports, longtime NBA voice and writer. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation.
Sports Illustrated presents the Media Podcast with Richard Deitch. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. Now, your host, Richard Deitch.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Lou Pellegrino. And this week, our guest is the Turner Sports reporter, David Aldridge. If you watch the NBA, you are familiar with David Aldridge and his work for Turner Sports, as well as writes for NBA.com. Very long and impressive sports journalism career. Started at the Washington Post, went to ESPN for many years, was at the Philadelphia Inquirer for a four-year stretch, and now has been at Turner, I think, for a dozen years or so. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation with David Aldridge. We talk about, in his opinion, how the league is covered, who's doing a good job, sort of the idea of transactional reporting versus different kinds of reporting. You know, we see obviously the Adrian Wojnarowskis and the Mark Steins, and we've also seen many other analytical people sort of forge through, Zach Lowe, John Schumann. It's a very interesting time in NBA media, and David Aldridge is at the center of that, so I think he'll be an interesting figure. Want to get into David's background working at the Washington Post with Michael Wolbon, Tony Kornheiser, Christine Brennan, and Tom Boswell. A pretty heady group during the 80s that David Aldridge worked with. And then his own journey from print to broadcast and how he morphed into that. And I think he's been an interesting figure, a very prominent, obviously African-American voice on sports television. And I'm going to ask him about why, at least in my opinion, the NBA seems to be the league which has been very progressive in terms of diversity of media when it comes to covering their sport. And we'll obviously ask him too about who he thinks are really thoughtful interviews, and maybe get into a little Greg Popovich as well. Obviously, he's a sideline person. All right, I think you're going to enjoy this. Here's David Aldridge. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Well, thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
All right, David, let's start off with this. And this is sort of an overarching question, and go as long as you want on this. But how would you evaluate right now the state of NBA reporting, the state of NBA writing, the state of NBA media coverage in general?
I would say that, like any sport that has experienced an explosion in the number of media outlets that cover it, there's good and bad with NBA reporting. I think there's certainly a lot of good work being done on the analytical side, whether it's John Schumann, our guy at NBA.com, who does really good work, or Kevin Pelton at ESPN. I mean, there's lots of people who are doing really good analytical work. And it's stuff that I pay attention to now more than I did when it first started, because there are some things of value that you can take from it. I certainly think that is an area where there's good work being done. You know, there's always a great sense of competition with regard to information. I think all of us work very hard at it. I think it's as good as it's ever been. I think the one thing I appreciate, I think all of us respect one another, even as we're trying to beat each other's brains out. And I certainly respect the people that I compete with, and I think they respect me. So that's always an ongoing day in, day out kind of battle. But there is some fluff amidst the wheat and the chaff, right? So, and you have to kind of sift through that as quickly as you can and move on to the stuff that's much more edifying and informational. So, I think that the coverage is good. I think that there are areas, especially, and it's not a criticism of blogging. It's just that there are fan blogs that purport to be more than fan blogs. And when people start taking what fan blogs say as what is actually happening, that's where you get into trouble. And there's just more of them now than there have been. But overall, I think the quality of the reporting, the quality of the story writing, I mean, we've always had great people writing stories about the NBA, you know, when I first started, whether, you know, Tony Cotton at Sports Illustrated wrote really good feature stories, and then Jack McCallum obviously was great at those long takeouts, and Jackie McMullen also, and now Lee Jenkins has taken that over at SI. He just does a remarkable job. He writes great takeouts. He's really talented at it. But there are places, all kinds of places, where you find good NBA stories. And I think that it's good to see that the proliferation has some positives as well as negatives.
There's a lot to get into there, so I want to start with this. David, I consider you, if I'm going to tag you as something, and I don't think any of us are sort of just one thing, but I consider you an information person or newsbreaker, and thus within that sort of framework, you are competing against people like Adrian Wojnarowski and Mark Stein and Broussard, et cetera. How much do you consider that group, that sort of first-tier preeminent group of NBA newsbreakers, how much do you consider them daily competition?
Oh, well, they definitely are. All of the people you mentioned, and as well as a few others, they are. It is daily. It is every day. You're looking to break stories and find out information. But I would not be truthful if I said, you know, that my every waking moment is dedicated to finding out information. That's not true, because I have lots of hats that I wear for Turner. And you know, it's not just information. I do sidelines for Turner, for TNT and NBA TV. I do studio work for Turner and NBA TV. I write a column for NBA.com every week. So I'm trying to address all of those masters on a daily, weekly basis. And I obviously want to break stories too, but that's not, you know, I just have a lot on my plate.
Right.
and it's okay. That's the job I've accepted. I wanted the job and I've taken it. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying that there's a lot that I do on a weekly basis that does not entail me finding out exactly, you know, what the status of J.R. Smith's negotiation is today.
Right.
When I can get to it, I try to update it as best I can. But I have so many other things that are part of my job description. You know, you try to do all of them and you hope you do all of them well. But to answer your question, obviously those guys all do a great job, and they're all very tough, and they have lots of sources, and they break a lot of stories, and you get mad when they break one that you didn't have. So you try to do the best you can.
You mentioned that, so that's that, you know, you stated that better than me. I mean, you're clearly a hybrid NBA media person, whether that's obviously working and multimedia as well, working obviously on television. You do radio, which you didn't even mention, obviously NBA.com and the sideline work. Getting back to the sort of the transactional nature of the NBA, which really, I mean, I guess this is with the NFL too, but someone like Wojnarowski has really taken transactional reporting, so to speak, to a new level, especially when we see him at the draft. You know, he's gained a lot of following for that. In your position, could one have these other jobs that you do and still break the transactional stuff daily, or do you really almost have to focus on that on a 24/7 basis to be a true transactional kind of broker, a true sort of, you know, day-to-day grind information kind of person, where even the smallest transactions are the ones you want to try to break first?
Well, look, there's only 24 hours in a day, right? I mean, there's only, you know, so you can't, an old producer at ESPN used to say, I can't create time. And he was exactly right. We all make decisions about what we're going to emphasize. Anybody who spends a lot of time doing this understands that to break stories, you have to be on the phone a lot. You have to constantly be texting people and talking to people on the phone and instant messaging them and all that sort of thing. I think, if you just look at what everybody does, I think the lines are pretty clear. I mean, I think Adrian and the others, Shams, also at,
Yahoo,
at the Vertical,
right.
I mean, they put a great amount of emphasis on what you call transactional stories. I mean, you know, from the biggest to the smallest, they want to have every piece of information. That's not my job. That's not my only job, I should say. When I was at ESPN, there was more of that because, at least at the beginning, we didn't have the NBA contract, so we didn't have games. So I didn't have to do sideline reporting and all the other things that entail it. So it was much more of my job was information. I would say at Turner, it's part of my job. It's an important part of my job, but it's not the only thing I do. And so, you know, there's just not going to be enough time to break every story, to break every free agent signing, every D-League, you know, assignment and things like that. And that, hey, that's great. And they've built a huge following doing it, and people like what they do, and, you know, they do a great job of it. I just have a different job description right now. You know, it, again, it's part of what I do, but there's just so much more that I'm doing right now. When I have to do a game, I have to do a game. You know what I mean? I mean, I have to prepare for two teams and get ready to broadcast the game. And so if I'm doing Cleveland and Toronto, as I'm doing this week, you know, I may not get to whatever Phoenix is doing right away. Hopefully I can, but, it, you know, that may be something that I don't get first.
Is Cleveland at Toronto, or is it at Cleveland?
No, it's at Cleveland.
All right, so either way, you might be getting, you might want to think about sneaking over to one of those baseball stadiums and maybe check out the playoffs.
I'd love to. You know, I wish I could do baseball. You know, I love doing baseball for tournaments. Again, that's another thing. You know, I did that for 5 or 6 years. So at the very beginning of training camp in the NBA, when everybody else is covering the NBA and doing stories, I was preparing to do a baseball series to cover, you know, a divisional series. So you can't really immerse yourself in what the Hornets are doing today, you know, when you're trying to get ready to cover the Phillies in Colorado. So, you know, you have to, you know, again, I'm not complaining. I love doing it. I love doing different sports. It makes you think with a different part of your brain. And that was great. But, you know, that will take away from your ability to cover the other things that you have to cover.
You know, the NBA is a fascinating league. I think it might be the most interesting league for me of the Big Four. And there's so much conversation about the stars in the league, whether it's LeBron or Kevin Durant, and both good and bad. My God, like so many people have made millions of dollars on opinion shows off the NBA. Given that you've sort of spent your life in the league, why do you think that is? Why are the sort of the opinions and the passion so high about the stars of the NBA, where that might not be the case for some other leagues? Even though those other leagues are popular, LeBron, Durant, Curry, people, even casual sports fans, I think have an opinion of them where they might not have the same opinion of the top baseball players or the top hockey players.
Well, there's lots of reasons of it for that. One is that's the way it's always been in the NBA. I mean, going back to Russell versus Chamberlain, you know, I mean, that's what kept the NBA afloat in the 60s was Russell versus Chamberlain. It was a much smaller league, but even then, the league was built on the play of its superstars and the availability of its superstars to the media. It's always been that way. Through that era, through Dr. J, through Bird, Magic, Michael, you know, Iverson, Kobe, all, and on and on and on. Part of the reason for that is basketball is a much more intimate sport than football or baseball. And again, that's not a criticism of football or baseball. That's just reality. You have 53 players on a football team. You have 12 on a basketball team. You have 25 on a baseball team. Football players are covered up most of the time. They wear helmets. They wear pads. I believe it was Seinfeld who said you work for laundry on an NFL team. You know, that's what you're rooting for. Other than people like Tom Brady and Peyton Manning who are on TV a lot and get commercials, I mean, they're just not – I don't think a ton of people would be able to identify Chris Johnson on the Arizona Cardinals, even though he may be the best back in football right now, right? So you just wouldn't be able to do it. And baseball is the same way. And baseball has never been a sport that really promoted the individual. They try to do it, but it never has really stuck, I don't think. Whereas basketball is almost always about the individual in the context of a team. I mean, Jordan is the perfect example of that. I mean, people were fascinated. I think that's why Sam Smith's book did so well about how you kind of harness this incredible individual talent into a team framework and try to be successful at it. It's kind of the ultimate yin and yang story. And so I think that's why people have always kind of gravitated toward the individual. In basketball, you can see the players. They're wearing shorts and a t-shirt, basically, you know. And until recently, at least, if you covered basketball, you were right on the court. You know, you were at courtside. And you were able to see the expressions and the reactions and the emotions of of all of those players. And now with TV, with the incredible increase in technology, you can see even more of those close-ups and HD close-ups of the emotions of players who play the game. So I think that's probably, to me, the main reason why individual players tend to create so much passion, good and bad, by fans, by media, by everyone, because they're just so much more recognizable, accessible. And I've learned one thing about TV, Richard. If you're on TV, people like you. You know, that's because they like TV.
Right.
So if you're on TV, they like you. And so that's, you know, and so people who are on TV a lot, like LeBron and the others, tend to get more attention.
You know, David, I want to ask you about sort of interviews, people in the NBA who are really thoughtful, but that you mentioned television brings up a pretty good journalism conversation, given that you have morphed between a very traditional print beginning at the Washington Post. You then went to ESPN. You had that four-year stretch at the Philadelphia Inquirer where your timing was interesting, and that's kind of the industry was blowing up as you were, or at least the print part of it, while you were at the Inquirer. So I can imagine your days there must have been interesting. And obviously now you're at Turner, big television presence, digital presence. What was that transition like for you to go from traditional print to television? And there's a lot of young people in the audience who probably would like to be multimedia types. How did you make the transition? What was easy? What was difficult? Having been on TV at least a number of times, you're always aware of your body, which is, I think, very weird for a print person. So given that you've sort of made that transition to the highest levels of sports broadcasting, what was it like for you, and what did you learn about that journey?
Well, I mean, I should start at the beginning of that journey, which was I was still at the Post, and George Michael, the late, great George Michael, offered me a job on Redskin Report, which was a local show on the NBC affiliate in D.C. I took it because, number one, it paid a lot of money, which I was stunned by because I didn't know what TV salaries were like. But number two, that was my intro to television, and I will never forget what George did for me. And we only did the show for 2 years, but it was such an eye-opener for me because George was a born performer. And I will never forget that I saw this very early on and throughout the 2 years I was on that show, is that George went out of his way to make himself look stupid so that the other people on the show would look smart.
Yeah, interesting.
And that was so revealing to me, that someone would be that comfortable in their own skin to do that. And I did the show. It was me and George and John Riggins and Sonny Jurgensen. Now, John and Sonny obviously were great football players, so he wasn't going to question their football acumen. But even with me, he would say things that he knew were wrong and stupid just so that I could correct him so I would look good. And it was so fascinating to watch someone do that, and I thought, wow, that's really generous of him to do that. And it was because he didn't have to. It could have been contentious, you know, the types of TV I'm talking about.
Right, of course.
It could have been that way, and it wasn't that way. We got along famously, we got along well, we laughed a lot, and so it was an eye opener to me that television was a medium that, if you were with good people, you could be made to feel comfortable. The transitions were great and numerous, and I'm so thankful that I worked with really good people at ESPN for 8 years, producers and camera people, audio people, who all were incredibly helpful to me in learning the business and the craft. Chris Mortensen, I when I first started, I was having problems just because, again, it was information. I had a lot of it. And I was frustrated because I couldn't get it all on the air. And I called Mort and said, Mort, because, you know, Mort's background, he worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution
yep.
many years before he went into TV.
Right.
And I said, Mort, I don't know what to do about this. And he said, you only have time to give him the headline. That's all the time you have. And it really clarified it for me. And I was like, yeah, I get it. So now it makes sense. Just tell him what you know. And that's it. Don't embellish it. Don't give any detail about it. Just tell him what you know. And it started to work out a lot better for me. You know, writing feature pieces for ESPN took a lot of time because, again, I had much more information. I wanted to be Haywood Hale Bruin and write these incredibly florid and wonderful pieces, and there's just no time for that because they got another highlight coming in. So I had to learn how to write fast and write clean. You know, it evolves. I still like to think I'm improving and getting a little better at this every day, and hopefully I am.
One of the things that, in the midst of your television career, correct me if I'm wrong, but your physical appearance changed. You dropped a lot of weight, and I wonder if that was something that you did on your own, that was something you were told by producers. We have a lot of people on this podcast who've been pretty honest about that, about the television part of it is very aesthetics-driven. Had agents on not too long ago who told me they have told clients, which is kind of stunning to hear, but I guess true, to have plastic surgery if it meant more money, et cetera. So, you know, these are not things you necessarily had to worry about if you're at the poster of the Philadelphia Inquirer, but in a visual medium, this affects everybody. So did that part of the equation impact you?
No. I lost weight because everybody on my father's side of my family died of strokes. And I didn't want to die of a stroke, and certainly not at a young age. I didn't need anybody to tell me I needed to lose weight. I knew that every time I looked in the mirror. So that was a decision I made starting well before I went into television, just because I knew I had to do something. And it came from just being heavy throughout most of my teenage life, and certainly after college, when, you know, your best friend is that bottle of beer that you're holding in your hand.
Right.
We became very close, that bottle of beer and I, when I was in college. So just a lifestyle change, and something that I knew I had to do. I've not had one producer. I've not had one agent. I've only had one agent. Nobody has ever said to me, you know, you need to lose weight to stay on TV, or you need to dye your hair, or you need to have a chin lift or anything like that. But I'm a man.
Exactly.
So that's different for me.
Right.
You know, I know I have many women friends in the business who have to deal with those things. And it's just part of the unfairness of being a female journalist, certainly a female sports journalist. And I've never had to deal with that. All of this has been kind of on my own, just because I wanted to see 60. And so hopefully I get to see 60, God willing.
David, what is the difference, as best you can describe it, between working for a place like Turner and also obviously working for the league with your NBA.com and NBA TV work versus working for a place like The Post or even ESPN? I think Washington Post, clearly an independent entity from the NBA. ESPN's a rights holder. But it's different. It's not the league. It's a rights holder. So you've traversed different paths. You've worked for True Independence with the Inquirer and the Post. You've worked for the league, and then you've worked for ESPN, which is a rights holder, kind of a hybrid. So what have you found in terms of how you've approached those jobs, depending on where you worked, depending on their relationship to the league?
Well, I would push back just a little on your question in this regard. I mean, I know that many people feel it's a distinction without a difference, but I think it's a very important distinction that, you know, Turner operates NBA TV and NBA.com.
Right. Fair point.
It is not the NBA. I have never had one conversation with anybody at the NBA about content. I've not had one conversation with anybody at the NBA about stories that I was pursuing. Don't do that story. The only time I had a conflict with the NBA was when I first started working at Turner. They, at the time, did not want us to talk about underclassmen who could potentially be drafted, because they felt like that would encourage more underclassmen to enter the draft. We argued that it was silly to not talk about, not Ben Simmons, but someone like Ben Simmons, who was obviously going to only play 1 year and then obviously be in the draft, and everybody knew it, and it would be silly for us to pretend like he wasn't going to be in the draft. And they, after about a year, said, you know what, you're right. Write about whoever you want. That's it, Richard. That's it. I've never had any other discussion with the NBA about anything that I've written or said or broadcast for the 12 years I've been at Turner. That's it. The only people that I see at NBA TV are people that work for Turner Sports. The only producers I see are people who work for Turner Sports. The only on-air talent I see, the only researchers I see, we all work for Turner. Turner covers the NBA. So I would push back on that. But other than that, I would say, you know, look, it's obvious. When you're in print, and I told people this many times when I was at the Washington Post, don't ask me about headlines, don't ask me about pictures. I have nothing to do with any of that. Everything that's under my name by David Aldridge, have at it. You see a mistake, tell me about it. You want to argue with me about something, let's do it. But other than that, it was the words that were under my byline, I was responsible for. And other than some editing here and there, you know, it was pretty much my say. I wrote what I wanted to write about who I wanted to write. Television is just a completely different medium. It's a collaborative medium. It does not matter what I write or how I look. If the shooter doesn't have a good shot and if there's noise in the background, we can't do it. It doesn't work, you know. So you've got to understand that quickly, and you have to respect the camera person and the sound person and the producer when they say, look, you don't want to do this because this will look bad or this will sound bad or it doesn't fit. I had to learn real early that, you know, you got to listen to those people, and you can't just try to plow your way through pieces alone. It's not going to work. So you learn to respect that, and you learn to work with people and understand what they have to say. It's the same thing when you do a TV broadcast. I mean, I'm sure you've talked to other silent reporters who tell you the same thing. We have so much material, we cannot get on the air.
Right, always.
You have to respect that. Even doing baseball, you didn't have enough time between pitches. You thought you did, and then somebody hits a three-run homer. So you have to stop your story that you spent all day working on. You know, so that's just the nature of being a sideline reporter. It's part of being on television, and you have to understand that. You know, when I was at ESPN, I don't recall there being the arguments we had about content were not about let's not do this because it'll make the league unhappy or upset. It was just arguments about content. I mean, I used to argue with my boss all the time about Charles Barkley. Charles would say something crazy, and, you know, more than one person would say, Charles is a racist. And I would say, you know, that's going to come as a real surprise to his white wife. you know, those are the types of arguments we would have. But other than that, I'm really trying to think if there was an example of the league pushing back on something that we did. Maybe there was, but I don't recall there being too many instances of that while I was at ESPN. And again, since I've been at Turner, and look, I'm not saying that the NBA and Turner aren't in partnership on NBA TV, and they are, and NBA.com, because they are financially. All I'm saying is that in terms of the content, in terms of what I do, I have had no interference, no suggestion from the league about anything. They call when I think I've made a mistake about a number, you know, they'll call if they want to push back on a position I've taken, but they have never said, don't write about that. Again, other than the drafting that I mentioned earlier, which was within a year changed to our benefit.
A couple weeks ago, I had Jack, as you mentioned before, Jack McCallum on with Michael Farber. Mm-hmm. It was a fun podcast to do with those guys. And one of the things we talked about were people in each of their respective leagues who were really, really good interview subjects for them, and then some of the people they had who were difficult subjects. The reason I bring this up is because Isaiah Thomas, interestingly enough, was on both sides. He gave Michael Farber a plant once after Michael Farber did a long series of pieces on him somewhere. And Jack McCallum, when he was covering the Bad Boys, said Isaiah was the toughest big star interview he had to do because there was a perception among Isaiah that Jack was a Michael Magic Larry guy, and Isaiah thought that extended. So that was interesting. That's my long preamble to you. In today's current game, given that you, as a national reporter and a sideline person, you've dealt with all the teams, who are really interesting, thoughtful people that you deal with in the NBA, either players, coaches, front office people? I think it'd just be interesting to hear who are those who really, really sort of understand what the media is about and have a very professional relationship on both sides.
I guess I would start with the elephant in the room, who was Greg Popovich, right? I mean, everybody, 99.9% of the people that come up to me say, gosh, Popovich must be a real jerk. And I try to explain to them that, and I said this to Mark Stein because he was doing a piece on sideline reporters and Pop, and I said, look, if either of my sons were talented enough to play in the NBA, and neither of them are, but if they were, I would want Greg Popovich to coach them. Because I think he is not only a great basketball coach, he is one of the best human beings I have ever dealt with. The problem is most people only see those 45 seconds when he doesn't feel like talking to me. the other 23 hours and 59 minutes and 15 seconds of the day, he couldn't be more engaging or helpful or honest about himself, his team, the league, everything. And he's a person who is genuinely curious about the world and wants to learn about other people, you know, and how other people live their lives. And so I always like talking to Pop about anything. And I think he's a fascinating person. That whole organization, R.C. Buford's the same way, and the players are all the same way. You know, they really want to engage you about the world. I mean, Timmy didn't talk a whole lot, but when he did talk, he was pretty good, you know. The problem is he just didn't talk very much, and that was just him. John Stockton was the same way. I was so angry with Stockton because at the Hall of Fame induction, the infamous Jordan one, people forget that Stockton was also inducted that year.
Oh, wow.
He gave this great, funny speech, and I went up to him afterwards, and I said, "You ass, you're funny. You never let me in on it. You never displayed this side of you." You know, there's just people like that. In terms of players, boy, people ask me that a lot, and I think it's a function of me, Richard, becoming old, you know, older, I guess I should say. Some of the people that I really like talking to are all older now, you know, some of the older guys, like Dirk Nowitzki's, I think, a really interesting guy to talk to. He's a really thoughtful guy about what's going on in the world and cares about it and is curious about it. And, you know, I guess Doc Rivers, I always like talking to Doc. I think Doc is an honest guy and is an engaging guy and thoughtful guy on a lot of things. Kobe and I had a weird relationship because I think, much like with Jack and Isaiah, I think Kobe thought I was a Shaq guy. And maybe I was, because Shaq was always funny and always had something interesting to say. And Kobe was more quiet. But toward the end, I mean, I had a great relationship with Kobe the last 5 years. I mean, it was really good. You know, we talked a lot about things, and he's a really smart guy. You know, I'm trying to think about Stern was always a great verbal opponent. He liked to argue, you know, especially during lockouts when he always thought we took the player's side on everything. So he would always engage us and engage me. Which was, I always enjoyed that because he really liked doing it. He was not shy about it. Cuban is a guy that is not shy about arguing about things. Mark Cuban, you know, actually, you know, convinced me that I was wrong about a couple of things that I believed were true, especially about fans and ticket prices and things like that. And he's a really smart guy. Obviously knows a lot more about business than I do. He's not as accessible as he used to be because he wants to get his own brand out there, which is, you know, it's okay. But I miss the days when he would really email me. We had long emails back and forth about any number of topics. I hope I answered your question. I mean,
yeah.
Those are some of the guys over the years that I have really enjoyed talking to and speaking to. And then there's guys that I just know more personally. You know, Chuck is a friend, and Chuck is a guy who is as comfortable in his skin as any superstar I've ever known. I mean, I tell people all the time, you know, people are fascinated by Charles because he has no airs and no pretensions and says what he means. And I have been in so many restaurants and bars with Chuck over a 20-year period, and they're amazed. And this, I'm telling you this, Richard, this is, and people don't understand this. You go to a bar with Chuck, he will buy everybody's drinks.
Right.
He will buy drinks for everyone. He will talk to anybody. He does not have any entourage other than, you know, a couple of people that have to be with him, if you know what I'm saying, for obvious reasons. But this is every night. This isn't just like, oh, what a special night. Chuck bought his drinks. No, that's every night. This is every night of his life.
Yeah.
And that's what's amazing to me is that he does this all the time. I mean, he does it all the time, and he's always available, and I am under no illusions. If Chuck and Kenny and Ernie and now Shaq did not feel comfortable with me, I would not be a Turner. I mean, I think that's just reality, you know? And not only are they comfortable, they want you to argue with them, and they want you to engage with them. And that's Tim Kiley also. I mean, the first day I was on the set, Kiley said, if you don't argue with Chuck, and if you look in that camera, I'm going to break your arm. he's just Chuck. Don't deify him. And that's kind of how we handle it. And that's, I think that's part of why the show has been so successful. I mean, that and Ernie, who's the best ever at what he does.
Yeah, you're so right on Barkley, having spent a lot of time with him, including once taking the New York City subway with him. Never seen a more famous guy, more comfortable with people, and truly comfortable with people than Charles Barkley. We'll finish up on a couple things here. David, you were part of Washington Post staff that obviously has many, many well-known alums in the sports media, from Michael Wilbon, Tony Kornheiser, Christine Brennan, Tom Boswell. I think Richard Justice was part of that staff. Your relationship with Tony Kornheiser obviously continues to this day. You do radio with him. I think you appear on his podcast. Why has that relationship work for you two? You know, just because you're part of a newsroom doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be linked to somebody for decades, yet you and Kornheiser obviously had some kind of chemistry together. What has that been?
I was fortunate, among the many fortunes I had of working at the Post when I did, and that's all George Solomon's credit. When I was at the Post, my physical desk in the sports department was right next to Wilbon and Kornheiser's desk. I should say their offices. They didn't have offices. But their offices were across the hall from each other, and my desk was right next to both of their offices. And so I tell people all the time, I saw PTI 10 years before it came on the air, because that's all they did, was scream at each other. And so you would be drawn into those conversations. I mean, Tony would come out and literally say, you know, what's the capital of Egypt? And Wilbon would go, hey, shut up, I'm on the phone with Gene Upshaw or something like that, you know. And they would have this banter back and forth, and they would draw you into it. And so we became friends, you know. I think over the course of time, you know, Tony has been very kind enough to invite me to his son's bar mitzvah, his daughter's bat mitzvah. He invited me to his son's wedding. I couldn't make it. He's mad at me for that. you know, Wilbon, same thing. We became friends. We all covered sports together, you know. We all liked sports, and we all liked each other. And in those days, in the 80s, I mean, people came to the office. I mean, everybody came to the office and wrote their stories. So no matter where they were, unless they were on the road with the team. So you just had this, you just developed these relationships over those years of spending time together, not just there, but in locker rooms and at games and stuff. I mean, they just... And so that friendship just kind of evolved. And so when Tony started radio, his national show at ESPN, since I was at ESPN and we had that previous relationship, he called me a lot about NBA stuff. And I guess he, you know, enjoyed the back and forth. And, you know, when he said, ask something particularly stupid, and I would say, no, Tony, that's not right. That became a meme and a thing, you know. and it just, that relationship just continued. And I've said this a lot, but I cannot stress enough how much I admire Tony for this reason. Nobody told Tony that he had to have me on the show and Mike Freeman on the show and Wilbon on the show. And nobody told him he had to have Liz Clark on the show and Jeannie McManus and Sally Jenkins and all those people. He just knew the show's going to be better if we don't just have five white guys talking to each other. The show's going to be better if we don't have a bunch of athletes who don't want to say anything on the show. The show's going to be better if we limit the calls. And so what he created out of his own intelligence and neuroses and whatever you have is this really eclectic group of people who all are kind of smart and all like each other, all enjoy the audience who's also smart and likes each other. I mean, I can't even tell you this was just a couple of months ago. They invited fans of the show, you know, the people who write the jingles and the songs and all that, to come to D.C. for an event. It was packed. It was just people who get it, who understand that sports is important. But let's talk about some other stuff, too. Let's talk about music, and let's talk about politics, and let's talk about things that are going on in the world. It would be an awfully boring place if I just talked about basketball all the time.
Right.
I mean, I do have an opinion about the other things that are going on in the world. It doesn't mean I'm right, but I enjoy expressing those opinions on Tony's show. I mean, that's why I love doing his show, because it is about sports, sort of, you know. So you can do other things, and you're not kind of belittled for it. It's embraced. It's encouraged, and not just for the people who are on the show, but the people who listen to the show. And I think that's why it's been successful for the last 15, 20 years and has gotten off to this incredible start as a podcast.
Yeah, I don't always agree with everything Kornheiser says or sort of believes, but I really respect how he's diversified his career into different mediums. And in particular, as you mentioned, he is an incredible loyalist to those he likes and puts on the air. And that is what has made his podcast and his radio work, I think, different than your traditional sports shows. The last thing, David, I want to get to you with, and you sort of just mentioned it before, when you're talking about, you know, not having this, like, basically sports radio or sports television show with the same five white guys. The NBA, in my opinion, is far and away the best league in terms of diversity of media. When it's come to diversity of media, you have historically seen black reporters for print organizations. You have seen women reporters both covering the league for newspapers as well as on television. And the league just comes off, in my opinion, far more inclusive than some other sports leagues. Maybe that's because the league is predominantly African-American. Maybe you could sort of, you know, the league has had some pretty eloquent spokespeople when it comes to civil rights and stuff. But I, as a prominent black voice in the media who covers that league, I wonder what your thoughts are on that and why the NBA has sort of been more progressive and more inclusionary than some other sports leagues when it comes to the makeup of the media that cover it.
Well, I would say part of it is aspirational, but part of it is also common sense. When I first started covering the league in the late 80s, say mid to late 80s, I think a lot of newspapers especially put African-American reporters on the beat, frankly, because a lot of white reporters didn't want to cover the league. And they still were in that kind of baseball-football axis. And so the opportunities that young black reporters got were inevitably going to be covering college basketball or the NBA. And I think part of it was also a belief and hope, and in some ways that was realized and some not, that maybe young black players would relate to and be more willing to speak honestly to young black reporters. There was a time when I was a peer of a lot of people I was covering. We were all the same age. We liked the same music. That was a long time ago, but it was true for a while. So that was a part of it as well. And I don't think the NBA is especially different when it comes to putting women on the beats. Certainly Leslie Visser has been covering the NFL for a long, long time on TV and in print. So, I mean, the NFL did have their examples. My dear friend, Andrea Kramer, has been, you know, she's the best reporter I've ever known. And I've told her that, and I've told everybody that. She's better than me, and I'm good. She's the best reporter I've ever known. And I don't mean sports reporter, I mean reporter. She's better than everybody I've ever seen do this job. And so there have been other sports that did it. But I do think that there's a comfort level in the NBA that I have experienced that does not exist in other sports. When you see people who look like you, you tend to relax a little more. There's no doubt about that. So when you see African-American players at the highest level, not that that's something you see in the NBA, but you also see that in other sports. But when you see African-American coaches and executives and team physicians and broadcasters and fans, you just feel more at home, I guess. And so that, you know, I can only speak for myself. I have always felt very comfortable covering the NBA, even when I was young and didn't know anything, not only because of that, but because, you know, I said this in Springfield a couple of weeks ago at the induction, that Steve Bulpet from the Boston Herald and Mike Monroe, who was at the Denver Post at the time, who were two older white reporters, you know, they were as responsible as anybody for me learning the league, because they were so incredibly generous and helpful to me and would introduce me to people and say, you know, talk to this kid, tell him, you know. They were incredibly gracious with me. And to me, there's just always been that in the NBA, that people are comfortable. Even people who are at a very high level and know more people and are bigger names, quote unquote, are more than willing to reach back and help other people who are just starting. And it's always been that way. Jack McCollum and David Dupree were incredibly helpful to me when I first started covering the league. You know, they would answer my stupid questions. I mean, it's just always kind of been that way. And so, you know, you feel like you have to pay it forward and do the same thing. And almost everyone does.
David Aldridge was, I should mention, honored with the Kurt Gowdy Media Award. That's when he's talking about being in Springfield. And that is, I wish I had the exact designation in front of me, but the shorthand, David, you can correct me if I'm wrong. It's basically presented to somebody either in the print or the electronic media who's made significant contributions to the game. Is that close?
To covering the league, yes.
To covering the league.
Journalism, I guess you would say, yeah.
Yeah, and it's very, very high.
Highlight.
Yeah, high, I mean, it's yeah, major high honor. McCallum is one of the guys that we mentioned before. I know Jay Billis was in there with David Aldridge, so that's pretty heady stuff if you are a reporter. All right, Dave, before we let you go, is there anything else that you that I did not ask you? I told you I'd get you out of here in about 45 minutes. Naturally, I have blown my assignment. I think we're at 49 or something like that at the moment.
Oh, well, that's okay. We can fix that in post.
Yeah, we can. That's right.
No, I'm just gonna, I am appreciative that you reached out and are interested in what I have to say about things. I'm just gonna go hunker down in the corner now with a bottle of bourbon and wait until November 9th.
Nice. You know, your Turner PR,
with the country,
your Turner, yeah, right. Both of us. Your Turner PR people would probably want me to ask you a basketball question. Do you expect to see the Cavs and the Warriors again, or will we get something different? We'll end it on that.
I would say, right now, barring some catastrophic injury to, you know, a member or more than one member of those two teams, I would certainly say they are the prohibitive favorites in each of their conferences going into the season. Certainly, I don't see any team in the East that I think can beat the Cavaliers as they are currently constituted. I'm assuming that at some point J.R. Smith resigns. I just don't see it. I mean, I guess you'd say Toronto and Boston are probably the two teams you'd look at that may challenge them this year, but I don't think either one of those teams can beat them four times.
Yep, same
in
here.
A playoff series. Golden State, you know, I mean, I can't dismiss the Clippers. I can't dismiss San Antonio, but I think there is a significant gap now between Golden State and the rest of the conference with Durant coming aboard, assuming that they figure things out, which I'm sure they will. They're smart guys, and there's nobody on that team right now that is a defending champion. And I think that's a very big carrot and incentive for that group of guys to get together and figure out a way to win something together. So I would certainly think that those two would get together again. And if the ratings are any indication, I think people will seem to like that matchup. And we'll see if they like it a third time.
I think they will. And I think we're going to see that again as well. All right, David Aldridge has been the guest. He is a reporter for Turner Sports. Covers the NBA. You could read him on NBA.com, follow him on Twitter as well. He also appears on Tony Kornheiser's podcast. And is there anything else I need to plug, David? Is there anything else you got?
No, I'm that's it. I got enough jobs now. Let somebody else have a turn.
You are indeed a hardworking guy. And for those who are on Twitter, the handle is DALDRIDGETNT. So David Aldridge on Twitter. All right, David, I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
My pleasure, Richard. Thank you for having me.
All right, back in the studio to wrap up quickly with Lou Pellegrino. My thanks to David Aldridge for his time. For a couple of maybe names that were mentioned there, George Solomon was the longtime sports editor of the Washington Post. One of your first to Chuck, obviously. Probably you can figure that out. That's Charles Barkley. That's his nickname. Lou, you know, we had McCallum and Farber on not too long ago. I really could talk to NBA reporters forever because I just find this league fascinating. And we were talking about this off air. I think part of the reason the league is fascinating is because it's so star-driven and they market individuals. So, like, you know, it's LeBron versus Steph. It's not always the Warriors versus the Cavs. And you really, you know, you not that you feel like you know these guys because that's a little ridiculous. Nobody really knows them except them. But they do feel closer to you than, like, a football player, at least in my opinion, or a baseball player. And there's just something about the NBA, and maybe it's because they market stars versus teams, that it, you know what I mean? The individual just feels bigger.
You know, the thing that was so great about the NBA is, you know, it got Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan became the face of the NBA, because we all remember the stories of Kermit Washington punching Rudy Tomjanovich and how the NBA was, games were getting blacked out. You weren't able to find NBA games.
Drug
you were
issues.
On tape delay, drug issues, tape delayed games, all that stuff. And then Jordan comes. Think of all the other sports. Think of hockey, think of baseball, think of football, think of soccer. Okay, now granted, we don't see very many soccer players on TV here. Now we have in the last couple of years. But you don't see a Be Like Bryce commercial for Bryce Harper, you know, promoting Gatorade. You don't see Sidney Crosby doing a McDonald's ad. You know, you see Peyton Manning doing things because right. It's Peyton Manning.
May in Canada for Crosby, but I know what you're saying.
Right, but you know, the way the NBA has been able to market itself, I mean, you see Blake Griffin commercials, you see Steph Curry commercials. The NBA, they're about the team, but they're also about the individual, and I think that's something that other sports need to follow. Because everything at the NFL is team, 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 team. Why isn't Tom Brady plastered on every endorsement deal possible? Same thing with a guy like Mike Trout or a guy like Henrik Lundqvist. You just don't see it. The NBA just has no problem saying, guess what, Steph? You're the star. LeBron, you're the star. And Blake, you're the star. It's great for them.
They've definitely figured out the marketing, and you're totally right about that. So David Aldridge, we appreciate, and previously before David Aldridge, Clinton Yates and Pam Oliver, got some good guests coming up. Don't want to announce them yet, but I think they're going to be pretty interesting and a little outside the box. Obviously, please check out, if you're interested, all the Sports Illustrated for Media podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud. Let me run down the group of people I have to thank for this podcast. Obviously, first and foremost, Lou Pellegrino, my producer. All the folks at Digital Media and at SI, John Wertheim, Ryan Hunt, Chris Stone, and Ben Eagle for supporting the podcast. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you soon on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.